Hi, everybody. My name is Joe Gray, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety day is August the 27th of 1988, and I'm really thankful for that period of sobriety. It's good to be here with you guys this weekend. I want to thank Keith and Sue, for asking us, and the job you guys are doing. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir, but y'all know what you're doing here, and I got to tell you, it's very, very attractive. All this enthusiasm and commitments and the things that y'all get together to do, it's wonderful to see. It's catching. And be proud of it. Keep doing it, because we don't find this like this everywhere we go. It's just not this way, and unfortunately. But you're doing a great job, and thanks to all the ladies that fixed our room and so nice and put all the goodies in there. I'm going to be sick. that's enough stuff in there to eat. I could be up here a week and never leave that room and be fine. It's just wonderful. And y'all do such a good job, and it's just a lot of fun being with you. And I thank y'all for this opportunity. As Kay said, she usually likes to go last, and she doesn't get to do that often. We sometimes get it swapped up, but not very often. And this is how it should be this morning, because I need to straighten out some of the things that she may have told you. But I'm so glad that y'all have A's and Al-Anons together, because they don't do that everywhere we go either. And I hear some disparaging things from behind these podiums sometimes about Al-Anon. It really makes me sad and sometimes angry when I hear some of this stuff that people say, because if it wasn't for Al-Anon, I'm sure I'd be a homicide statistic this very day. Because I know because of Al-Anon, it saved my life many times. But I have these friends, Linda and Craig, and they're just wonderful people. And Craig's an AA, and Linda, of course, an Al-Anon. And a few years ago, Craig went to the doctor to get a physical for insurance purposes, and the doctor told him, he said, "Craig, I hate to tell you this, but said you've got a rare blood disease, and you only got 24 hours to live." He said, "Are you sure?" He said, "I've had my colleagues run all these tests 3 or 4 times, and I'm just sorry to tell you that, and I don't know what else to say, and we're just very sorry." So Craig leaves, he goes to the park, and he walks around all afternoon just worried about this. What am I going to tell Linda? And it's just awful. And he finally goes home, and he breaks the news to Linda that he only has 12 hours left to live. And so they go to bed, and he said, Craig asked Linda, said, "You know, sir, I've got this 12 hours left. He said, do you think we can make love one more time?" She said, "Well, I suppose we could." So they make love, and over the night, he rolls over, and he punches her in the back and said, "Linda, I got 8 hours left. Do you think maybe we could make love one more time?" She said, "Well, I guess we could, Craig." And so they did, and way over the night, he pokes her in the back and said, "Linda, we have 4 hours left." She said, "Craig, I got to get up in the morning, and you don't." That's the kind of Al-Anons I hang out with. You know, we spend a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous telling them what it's like, what happened. And we should. We should spend a lot of time doing that. That's the way we can communicate one to another what happened. Well, you know, we're not the only ones that do that. These people out here that have never been inside one of these rooms, they do it all the time. I'll give you a for instance. You can hear a grinding car crash right out here. One of us would run out there and ask them what happened. I'm sure we would. Or you're at home and you hear a big crash of dishes out there in the kitchen. Probably go out there and ask what happened. Or you hear a young child cry out in agony. Somebody run in and ask him what happened. You remember, don't you? I'm sure you do. About 2,000 years ago, when the master healed the blind man, and he asked him what happened. He said, "I don't know. Once I was blind, and now I see." You ask me what happened? I don't know. Once I was drunk, and now I'm sober. I tell you what I think happened to me. I think Alcoholics Anonymous happened to me, and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was introduced to a loving God that I never knew existed. And this is what happened to me. This is my story. At one time, I think I was well. I was about 6 years old. There was nothing wrong. Everything was great. I grew up, I was born and raised in a little country town down in Mississippi, and all us kids did, we just played in the creeks and the woods and the ponds, and it was just fun. It was no big deal back in those days, no a lot of drugs or predators or none of that kind of stuff. We just kind of did what we wanted to do. Then it happened. I fell in love with an older woman. Her name was Susan. She was 7 and I was 6. And Susan and I were up underneath her front porch steps playing show and tell or feel and squeal or one of them. And and her mama caught us, and she drug us out from underneath those porch steps. And everywhere was no clothes on. And she looked down at me, and she said, "Joe Gray, if you do this again, your thing will fall off." I looked down at Susan, and hers already fell off. I guess I thought I was out with an older, more experienced woman or something. I don't know. But the significant thing about that was her mother grabbed me by the hand and took me down to my house. My mother lived about 4 or 5 houses down the block. Marched me in my mother's kitchen and told her what she had discovered us doing. And then they went home. And my mother looked at me. She said, "Did you do that?" I said, "No, ma'am, it wasn't me." Now I know she didn't believe that. But nothing ever was brought up or said about that incident ever again. This is what I heard. You tell a lie, and somebody believes it, not a lie anymore. And I spent my whole life right into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous telling you how I wanted you to perceive me, and most of it wasn't even close to the truth. But it didn't matter. You see, that's just the way I live my life. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 15 years old. Me and 3 of my pals went out to the county line, and I bought a 6-pack of Busch Bavarian beer. I'll never forget it. I drank all 6 of them, and the next thing I know, we're in a truck stop, and I'm arm wrestling this truck driver. I don't know about what, can't remember. But I remember it was a hot June night in 1958, and I got a little sick, and I went outside, and I threw up, and I laid down in the back seat of that old 49 Plymouth. And a little while later, the guys came out and said, "Well, let's go home." I said, "No, let's go get some more beer." Well, they didn't want to, but they took me back out there, and I got me another 6-pack. Now, I don't remember how many of those I drank. I don't remember if it was 1, 2, 3, or all of them. It didn't make any difference because I was different, you see. Real men like me could drink, get sick, throw up, go drink some more, and those panty waists I was running around with couldn't do that. So I was different right from the very get-go. Now, it talks about me in chapter 3 more about alcoholism. It says in there that alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Well, I lost the ability to control my drinking that very first time, and this is how I know that. About a year before this drinking spell, me and the same bunch of guys had gone fishing and camping on this lake. And we were too young to get anything to drink, not by today's standards, of course, but back in the 50s, it was a little more difficult for teenagers to come up with something to drink. But we needed to do something, so we got some cigars. And I remember sitting by that campfire smoking that old green Have a Tampa cigar, and I must have swallowed a little bit too much of that juice. And I got sick, and I threw up, and I was sick all night long. And those guys got up the next morning, they were cooking bacon and eggs around that campfire, and it was making me sick all over just to smell them cooking. I told them, I said, "As long as I live, I'll never smoke another of this darn cigars." And as I stand before you today, I've never had another cigar. But it wasn't that way with drinking. I drank every chance I got. I lied, I cheated, I stole for it. I did everything I could to get something to drink. And I didn't know until much later that what I did that for was because I just needed it. Because I don't know when I became an alcoholic, but I know when I became liking it. And I became liking it right from the very start. I remember in December of 1958, up until that point, I was pretty much a beer drinker. And I know it was December of 58 because it was the New York Giants and Baltimore Colts NFL championship game. And we had watched that game at my friend's house. We walked out under the street light in front of his house. I had a pint of Smirnoff vodka. He had a pint of Smirnoff vodka. We took the caps off them away and said, "I bet you I can kill mine before you can kill yours." And when he finished his, I still had about that much in the bottom of mine, and I haven't liked him since. But that's just what happened, you know. That's just how I started drinking. I started drinking like that from the very get-go. Well, I finished high school without a whole lot of fanfare, and I got in a little bit of trouble with the law, a little bit of trouble with school. Matter of fact, I got kicked off the basketball team my senior year for drinking, and it was okay because we had a new coach that year. We were losing, didn't have a very good season, so it was okay. But I finished high school, and I got a football scholarship to college, and I went off to college to play football. And it was about the third week of fall practice, and I hurt my knee, and they wanted to operate on it, and I didn't want them to do that. I knew a bunch of guys that had knee surgery, never played ball again. Some of them never walked right again, and so I wasn't up for that knee surgery, so I told them no, I was going to rehab it on my own. And they said, "Well, no, it's serious, and if you don't let us do it, then we're going to rescind your scholarship." I said, "Well, you guys can have it. I'll just go to Texas." I had been to Texas once. I had an uncle out there that had his own business, and he told me once, if, you know, if college doesn't work out for whatever reason, let me know, and you got a job with me. Well, I didn't even know what he did for a living. But I called him. I said, "College failed me." And he said, "Come on to Texas." I jumped on the bus, and it took me 24 hours to get out to Wichita Falls. And I show up there and find out what he did for a living. Him and another guy had this oil field equipment company, and he wanted me to learn it from the ground up. And he put me to driving an 18-wheeler delivering equipment all over Texas and New Mexico and Colorado and Oklahoma and around. And so that's what I was doing. And as I said, I was pretty much a beer drinker in those early years. I liked bourbon whenever I could get it, but I didn't make a lot of money. So, but anyway, we went on a trip. And I was driving one truck, and this other guy was driving a truck, and we stopped in Tucumcari, New Mexico, for the night. And he said, "Get the room, and I'm going to go across the street and get us something to drink." So he went across the highway and came back with two quarts of Champion bourbon. And we sat on those two little twin beds and watched about a 10-inch black and white TV and watching the test pattern. And we was passing that jug of Champion back and forth across the end of that bed until we were just drinking it straight out of the bottle until we either went to sleep or passed out. I don't remember which, but back in those days, I could drink a lot, and I could work late and do lots of stuff, and I thought everybody could do that. And it was no big deal. We went on to other trips, and we were in Arizona one time, and in the middle of the night, about 2 in the morning, I'm driving down the highway, and this thought comes to me, "You know, your love life sucks." Well, it did, because, you know, I was gone all the time. And the next thought right after that was, you know, if you were married, you'd probably have a job in town. And so when I got back to Wichita Falls, I had this one suspect, and I told her this thought I had. She said, "That's a good idea. Let's get married." So we got married, and I left my uncle's company and did get a job in town. And things were looking up. I got a little better job. And right across the street from where I worked was one of my all-time favorite drinking establishments. And I was always a bar drinker. I love the bars. I love the smell of them. I love the music. I love the stale carpet, the stale smoke, the music. I just loved it all. And this is one of my all-time favorite places. It was called the Wee Lounge. Very classy place. It was spelled with a French spelling of "we." It had to be classy. And I'd get off over there at work about 5:30, and my wife would expect me home. And I'd tell her that morning, "I'll be home 6. And I meant it when I said that. But I'd look at that Wee Lounge over there, and I'm going to go over and have a couple. And I'd go over there, kick the door open, and the smoke's down about like this. You got to look under the smoke, see who all's there. And the jukebox is over here playing, and George Jones, and Buck Owens, and Ray Price, and, oh, God, those cute little waitresses running around in there, those tight Levi's on. I couldn't go home, man. I was already home. And I'd do that night after night after night. I never will forget was the first time I read Bill's story, and he's talking about beating on the bar, asking himself how did this happen again. I've done it hundreds of times. How did this happen again? I didn't mean to do this. It'd be 2 o'clock and I'm there drunk, beating on the bar. I didn't mean to do this. How did this happen? Did it over and over and over. And my wife would admonish me for things like that, and I was making things very unhappy for her. And this time we had our first child, and the baby was about 9 months old. I came in one night as I was used to doing, after everything else had closed. All the bars closed about 2, and I had nowhere else to go, so I'd go roaring in home between 2 and 3 and usually falling in the door. And it happened to me this night. I fell on the floor, and she went and woke the baby up, and she came and she held the baby up like this and said, "If you love this baby, you wouldn't do this." And I loved that baby, and I couldn't stop. I didn't know why. That was 1963. I could have used this program in 1963. I didn't know it was here. Probably wouldn't have come had I known it. You know what they say about us. You know, we're just not ready till we're ready. And along about that time, things started happening, you know, negative things. I went to work one day, and they called me in and said, "You're fired." "For what?" "Well, you're in charge of the inventory, and we got a bunch of a new shipment of hand tools that disappeared out of the back of the warehouse. We figure you're in on it because they don't show up in the records." "No, they don't. I never checked them in yet." "Well, we think you're involved, so you're out of here." God, I had a deep resentment against them about that. God almighty, I didn't know anything about those hand tools. Now, I had been stealing money off of that gasoline credit card for about a year and a half, and supplementing my drinking money, but I could justify that. They weren't really paying me what I was truly worth anyway. And so I just left, you know, all indignant, without any reason. I've been wrongly fired, and screw you guys. I'll just go work for your competitor. We'll break you right in old company. That's what I thought. That's not what it said. I went all the way down to Louisiana and got a job with one of their competitors, and gosh, I had a better job. I was driving a better car, wearing better clothes, drinking better whiskey, and sometimes drinking in better places. Not all the time. Nothing else changed. Hanging out with the same bunch, couldn't go home drinking and carousing, doing what we do. And I do this for a while, and I've been over in Natchez, Mississippi one night, been over here for a couple of days, drunk. And I thought, well, I better get home. I start home, and I get back to where the town that I worked in about daylight. I didn't even go home. I just kept the same clothes on that I'd been working in for a couple of days. And noon that day, I'm driving down the road, and I go to sleep at 12 and drift off the road and dead center this oak tree and total this brand-new company vehicle. And woke up in the hospital, and this doctor was over me sewing my mouth up. My teeth were loose. I had stitches all over my face. And he asked me, he said, "Do you think you may have a problem with alcohol?" I said, "No. Alcohol had nothing to do with this. This was a lack of sleep caused this wreck." And I really believed that. And I didn't think about that incident again until after I got sober in AA. And once, it came to me one night, and the reason, and it came to me why that doctor asked me that. He asked me that question because he could smell the alcohol coming out of the pores of my skin. Because I could smell it. I can smell it right now. I know exactly what it smelled like laying on that gurney that day in that hospital getting sewn up. It was no question in his mind about it. It was alcoholism, and it certainly was. But I didn't know it then. But you start doing things like that, you start wearing out your welcome, you know. And I met this guy from Denver with Standard Oil Company, and he said, "You know, you need to get out of these Louisiana swamps. Come with me to Houston. I'm going to introduce you to some of my accounts down there, and they're looking for some young guys who can sell refined lubricants, refined oils products." I said, "Fine." I went with him to Houston. He introduced me. They hired me. Gosh, I got a better job, driving a better car, wearing better clothes, drinking better whiskey, drinking at a lot better places. These guys were high-dollar people. They gave me a bunch of credit cards and club memberships and a nice car. And they had a hunting lease down in South Texas. They had a private fishing lake down at Brazoria. They said, your job is take these customers to play golf, take them to fishing, take them hunting, buy them plenty of whiskey." I said, well, you got the right cat for this job, I'll guarantee you. And what I'd do, I'd buy a quart of a case of bourbon in quarts and a case of scotch in quarts, and I'd put them in the back of the trunk of my car, and I'd put an empty case in the middle. And this is the way I worked. This is my alcoholic arithmetic. A customer could have either a jug of bourbon or scotch. He could not have one of each. And so I'd give him whatever his choice was, and I'd put one each in my box, is how it worked. And God, I always had plenty to drink, had plenty of fast friends, and never went home. I just stayed in those bars and just had a wonderful time. Now, I was wearing my family out, of course, as you can imagine. But I was having a great time myself. I did that for a while, and for about a year or so, and things were going well, and all of a sudden they sold that company. God, I couldn't believe it. Sold it a bunch of Eastern guys from Philadelphia. I mean, I didn't like them the very moment I met them. Y'all seen those old movies with James Mason in them, haven't you? That's what these guys all talked, a little kind of little clipped little British little accent. And they all had three-piece suits, and they had a gold watch in this pocket, and the chain went over here on this pocket. I just didn't like them. And they called us in one day and said, you guys are doing a good job, but do it without spending so much money. Y'all buying way too much whiskey. We're going to take some of these club memberships back. And they had a box at the Astrodome. They took that away from us. And only the executives are going to use that. And I thought, well, that's all you care about us, you pricks. I'll just quit your old company. And so I quit and went across town, got another job selling heavy equipment. And nothing changed. I'm still in the bars, the same ones, because I'd gained a pretty good reputation with all the bartenders and all the club. They all knew me, and I didn't spend money quite as freely as I once did, but I didn't take the edge off of my importance to them. And so I'd still do the same thing, and I couldn't go home, and you know the drill. Well, I did this for about a year, and I had met another guy in that company up in Dallas, and he called me one day, and he said, we'd like you to take a transfer up to Dallas. Would you like to fly out and take a look and see if you'd be willing to do it? I said, well, I'll come up. So I flew up, and he and three of his other salesmen picked me up at Love Field and went straight to a bar. And we stayed out all night drinking and chasing the God. It was wonderful. And next morning, about 7, they put me back on the plane. I'm flying to Houston. And just before I got on the plane, he said, well, what do you think? I said, oh, I'll take the transfer. And I'm flying back to Houston, and I'm thinking, you don't even know what your job's going to be. You don't even know what your territory, you don't even know what anything about this is going to be. You don't even know if it's going to be the same money or better money. You didn't even ask. But I didn't care. I'd already found my people. And so I took that transfer. And August the 15th, 1968, I moved to Dallas. Nothing changed. Hung with the same people, did the same stuff. Now, by this time, we had two kids. I worked there for a while, and they saw management potential in me. They asked me to go to Fort Worth and run the branch in Fort Worth, so I did that. And while we were there in Fort Worth, we had our third child. Now, I'll give you a little quick example of what I was as a husband and father. You already got a pretty good example, I think, but this will really tell you. When that first child was born, I was at home with her mother in bed. When her water broke and the bag was packed, we'd get up, we'd go to the hospital, and she has the baby. When the second one was born, we were still living in Wichita Falls, but I'd been down in Arlington for about a week drunk in a motel. And I knew that baby was due sometime right about now, and I thought, well, I better get home. It was in the middle of February, it was snowing, it was about 20 degrees, and I got home, and just as I pulled in front of the house, she was on her way out of the front door with her own bag, and she was ready to drive herself to the hospital that time. So I got to go from the house, at least to the hospital. When the third one was born, we was in Fort Worth, and I'm drunk in Jimmy's Club down on West 7th Street, and a friend of mine came by, and he said, your wife's in the hospital, going to have that baby, and you can't drive, you're too drunk, I'm going to drive you. So he drove me up there. By the time we got there, she had just had the baby. Walked in, saw her, saw him. Went back to the bar where I stayed the rest of the night. I don't know who stayed with those other two kids. I'm sure a nice neighbor did, but I never asked and didn't care. I didn't want to know. I couldn't think of that. All I was thinking about was getting that next drink. And I didn't know that then, but that's what it was. Well, things rock on, and I asked to come back to Dallas. I didn't like I didn't like management and staying in it and all that kind of stuff. And so they let me come back and go back to in sales again. And after about another year, our marriage had just imploded, mainly from my actions and attitudes and what I had done. And I remember one day I was in one of my second all-time favorite drinking establishments, and it was on a Friday. It's about 3 o'clock, and the notion hit me, you know, that family is just holding you back. They're keeping you from enjoying life. What you really need to be is divorced. Now, old Norm Alpha used to say an alcoholic should either think or drink. You should never do them both at the same time. Well, I was thinking while drinking that day, and I thought, well, this would be a good day. I went home, and I was going to get my clothes and stuff and be gone before she got home from school with those kids. And I almost made it. I had my car packed, and about that time, she and my middle son came in from wherever they had been, and they saw my car, of course, and then she knew what was going down. And so she, as bad a husband as I was, as bad a father as I'd been, she begged me, she said, don't leave us. What's going to happen to us if you leave? And then my son got down on his hands and knees. He was 7. And he was holding me around my right ankle, and he said, Dad, please don't leave us. He was big brown eyes and tears rolling down his cheeks. He said, please don't leave us. And I tried to walk away from him, and he wouldn't turn loose of my foot. And I turned and slung him off of my leg down that hall, and I saw him bang up against that wall with the most fear, a shock of any eyes I've ever looked into. And I turned around and walked out of that house and never even gave it a thought. And I was back in that same bar within 30 minutes having another drink. I didn't think about that again until after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that divorce got over finally, and it was nasty and messy, and of course, and took a while. It took almost a year to get through all that, but we got through it. And I hit the streets running, and I'm out on the streets about 3 years doing what we do. And all my good friends were getting married, you know. Some of them for the first time, some of them for the 10th time, but they were all getting married. And one asked me, he said, when are you going to get married? I said, man, me, I'm never getting married again. Me and marriage just don't work. It wasn't 3 days, maybe 4. When he asked me that question, I was over in Fort Worth at the Colonial Golf Tournament, minding my very own business, down in the bar, and I looked over there, and there she was. She's already told you how that kind of came about, but and for what my memory is, that's pretty accurate. I did ask for her number, and she wouldn't give it to me, but her girlfriend did. She did say, I don't want to go out with you guys like you're too much trouble. That's all true. And she did get up and go to the restroom, and I grabbed her in the hall, and I said, I'm calling you. And she said, well, big boy, let's just go out tonight. And all that's true. And when I told her I can't, I'm not that kind of guy. I don't break my dates to go with you, and I want to break a date with you to go with her. I'm in all that. Now, the part I disagree with, and I disagree with this every time, she says I had an ugly blonde sitting on my lap. I don't think I've ever had an ugly anything sitting on my lap. But I can't swear to it either. But anyway, after that day, I called her the next day. We did come back to the tournament, the golf tournament. And as she said, last month we celebrated 31 years of marriage. Now, another thing I'm going to have to take exception to. She says I came to her house with 2 black garbage bags. That is not so. That is not so at all. I mean, I may have had some of my stuff in a bag, but I had luggage. I had a car. I had a brand new car. I had a stereo. I had a bed, a bedroom suit. I had a stereo. I had a few things other than 2 black garbage bags, but I just had to straighten that out. I just couldn't let that go. But all the rest of that stuff, I'll tell you what, it was a nightmare from hell. Those kids, boy, as she said, alcoholism was breaking out in every corner of the house. I'll give you some examples. Get a call one day at my office, and it's the principal of Hillcrest High School. Do you have a child named Kevin? Well, we do. Well, come get him. He just tried to burn Hillcrest High School down. Okay. Go by and get him and take him home. And next day, another school would call. Do you have one named Stacy? Well, yeah, we do. Well, come get her. She's down in the infirmary. She's having that far away feeling again. Well, I knew what that was. I had had that a few times. And go by and get her. The next day, another school will call. Do you have one named Darby? Yes, we do. Well, come get him. Him and another kid just jumped out of the second floor window and they're chasing a rabbit across the athletic field. Okay? Come get him. Next day, Dallas police call. You have one named Darby and Kevin? Yes, we do. Well, come get him. We got him in jail again. Well, what do you got him in jail for this time? Well, they threw a water balloon off the toll road at Royal Lane and knocked the windshield out of this lady's classic automobile. Get downtown, it's a 1960 Dodge Dart. But it was 1985. She said it was 25 years old. It's a classic. Okay. I know one thing, trying to buy a new windshield for a 60 Dart was a price of more than $1,300 for it. We finally found one at a junkyard for $100. But next day, the FBI called. You have one named Beaver and Stacy? Well, yes, we do. Well, they know it's a federal offense to make long-distance phone calls and just charge them to at random numbers out of the phone book? I said, they probably don't, but I'll explain it to them. It was something from some legal entity every day. It wasn't the same one every day, the same kid every day, but somebody would call us every single day. And we didn't know it was alcoholism. God almighty, it was something. She became, golly, she could toss a room better. And you've seen these cops shows on TV where they go and toss a cell? she taught that 101. Cell tossing 101, that's her. They used to call her Dickless Tracy. She was so good at it. One time, she found a bag of pot on a string hanging inside the wall behind the wall switch plate. After she found that, they quit. She can't keep it in the house. That was their last deal. They started keeping it outside. Oh, man, it was something. But we didn't know it was alcoholism. Didn't have a clue. Now, she didn't talk much about my drinking. Now, when my first marriage, I drank. I've already told you how I drank. Well, that second marriage, I knew that I didn't know how to be a husband and father. All I knew, I was going to have to do a 180 from what I'd done before. And so that's what I had done. I kept drinking all right, but now I had moved it from the bars to the house. And I'm drinking at the house every day. And if I go anywhere, she'd go with me. I didn't ever try to leave her alone or run away from her or get rid of her. She'd go with me. So consequently, I drank when we were gone, and she never noticed there was any problem because I stayed pretty much out of trouble by the rest of this time. I just drank, you know. And occasionally I'd overindulge with drinks and other substances, and I'd go blind while I was driving, and I'd say, "Kay, I'm blind again," and she'd reach over and the wheel, and she'd say, "Okay, slow down, speed up, let it move to the right, turn to the left." So we do that a few times, but for the most part, I just did this at home, and those kids had just driven us crazy. So all of a sudden, these things started happening. And they started winding up in treatment, as she said, and we didn't know what happened. And they told us that you have to go to some Al-Anon meetings or you're not going to be able to see them. Well, I didn't care if I saw them again, to tell you the truth. They were a pain in my neck, but Kay said she still loved them, and she wanted me to go with her. So I'd go with these Al-Anon meetings, and yeah, I just couldn't get there. I mean, these little white-haired ladies, all their husbands were drunk. Well, my husband wasn't drunk. I had a bunch of drunk kids, and I couldn't understand. So after one of these kids got out of treatment the last day, there's a little bitty counselor. She's about that tall. She walks up to me and says, "You might want to go to some open speaking meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous." Me? For what? Well, if you'll go to some of those, you'll understand how alcoholism has affected these kids and affected your whole family, and you'd be a big help to them if you understood how some of this stuff works. I said, well, I guess I could go. So I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the last Friday night of November 1986. He knows that's not my sobriety date. But I went there, and the guy nailed me. He was a speaker meeting. He just nailed me. And I wanted to come back to the next one. They said Sunday morning at 11. I go back Sunday morning at 11. That guy nailed me. And I started going three or four meetings a week, speaker meetings, just listen to the speaker and go in and drink. And I did that for 22 months. I'd go to meetings and then go drink. I didn't want to stop drinking. I didn't want to tell you I wanted to stop drinking. because I didn't want to stop drinking. I don't endorse doing that, by the way, but that's what I did. And but I must have heard something, because along about the end of that, I got to tell you this first. When we first started going to AA meetings, I had gone to the doctor for examination, and he called me in. He said, "You've got diabetes." "What?" "Yeah, you got diabetes." And he said, "How much do you drink?" And I said, "Well, I drink a couple every day." He said, "I don't care how much you drink." He said, "Drink all you want. You can keep on drinking, and I'll tell you what's going to happen to you. You're going to come in here one of these days, and I'm going to have to take off your foot or your leg or remove a kidney." And he got down, and his nose was this close to mine. He punched me on in the chest. He said, "Or you may never, ever be able to make love again." At that moment, you people had what I wanted. I wouldn't go to any length to get it. And I didn't drink anything for about 10 days. And calmly started drinking again, drank for another 20 months. But at the very end, I had quit going to meetings because I knew I wasn't doing what y'all were doing. Y'all were serious. Y'all were really not drinking. And I was. And it just wasn't working. That head full of AA and a belly full of booze thing, boy, that is real as I've ever seen. And one night, she came in from an Al-Anon meeting, and I headed up to here. I wanted a divorce. This was awful. Our life was in shambles. And so I told her. She came down that back hall. I had my finger out, and I said, "Let me tell you something. I want a divorce. You don't make me happy anymore." She looked at me with those cold Al-Anon eyes, and she says, "I'm not responsible for your happiness." And walked right on down the hall, went right by me. I got so mad, I went to a meeting. Hadn't been to one in about a month. I go in there, and I said, I'm going to get somebody to talk to her. I asked this guy, I said, "Hey, you know what she just told me?" He says, "What's that, pal? I told him, and he said, "Well, since she's right, I don't want to talk to you. Let me go over here and talk to this guy." Got me somebody else to talk to and told him the same thing. He said, "Oh, buddy, get a life. I don't want to talk to you either. Let me talk to a woman alcoholic. She'll understand what I'm saying." I look down the hallway, and there's a doorway, and it's open, and I can see the light from that room shining down on the hall, on the floor. And I walk down and look in this room. It's about 25 women in there. All of them standing up, just ratchet going like this. One sitting down. She looked like she would understand. I didn't know it was Gracie A., and I walked over there to her. I said, "You know what my wife said to me a while ago?" She said, "What, honey?" Now, you got to watch them when they call you honey like that. And she grabbed me by the pants leg and pulled me down in a chair right next to her. And she kind of patted me on the knee and said, "What, honey? You got to watch those patters, too." And I told her. And she said, "You know," said, "she's right." Said, "She's not responsible. You are." And I knew when she said that, I knew that she was right. For just a split second, my whole life just flashed in front of me. From what I had done, my behavior, my drinking, from that first marriage, how I had ruined all of that and all their lives, and the same thing was fixing to happen again. Plus, what that doctor told me was coming back: if you don't stop drinking, you're going to give yourself up to me a piece at a time. I thanked her, and I got up, and as I walked out of there, I didn't even stay and get her desire chip that night. I just left. But I knew that night I wasn't going to drink again, God willing. And the next day I came back and got a desire chip. That was August 27th, 1988. Haven't had a drink since. Now, has it always been wonderful? No, it hasn't. Everything that can possibly happen to people has happened to us. Death, divorce, IRS, business failures, kids drunk, and all kind of stuff. Family dying and... But I can tell you this, nothing has ever happened to me so bad that I thought taking a drink was going to make it better. I've only done two things right since I've been here. I've never taken a drink of alcohol, and I've never followed the wrong example in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's some here, maybe not here, but they're out there. And I've been fortunate. When I got here, I ran into a bunch of old-timers. And I'd like to tell you today that I ran to those old-timers and say, "You guys have what I want. Can I come go with you?" I'd like to tell you that, but that's not what happened. They sought me out and said, "Come. Come with us. Do this, because this is what we do, and this is how we stay sober." And I just started going with them. I can't tell you why. I just did. And I remember I didn't have a sponsor yet, and But I was going with these old guys all over, listening to this speaker, going there, listening to that speaker. So one of them came to me one day. He said, give me $50. We're going to a conference in Oklahoma. I said, I don't want to go. He said, that's not what I asked you. Now, I didn't know they'd already had, she was already signed up. She was going already. Those Al-Anons had just swooped her up, and she was gone. And I didn't want to go. And he said, oh, okay. And he turned and walked away, and he stopped. And he turned around and he looked at me. He said, you've been running around with us for a couple of months. You've been going here, you've been going there. If you don't want to do that, why? If you don't want to do what we do, why are you going? Why aren't you going? I said, well, he said, why have you been hanging out with us? I said, well, I guess because you old guys have what I want. He said, if you want to find out how we got what we have, come and do what we do. If you don't come and do what we do, you'll never know how we got what we have. And he turned and walked away again. And I followed him. And I gave him $50, and I went on that conference. And Keith and Sally were the first speakers I heard. Keith and Sally Carpenter were the first speakers I heard at a conference. And that weekend just changed my sobriety. It was awesome. It was really awesome. And I'm so glad. One of those old guys became my sponsor. And he was my sponsor for the first 6 years I was sober. And then he got lung cancer, and he was dying. And I went down to see him, and the day I went to see him, he had cancer. It had just eaten him up. I mean, it was all in his, it was starting out in his lungs, but it was in his liver and his ribs and his backbone. It was an awful pain. And he got to die at home under the hospice program. And so I went to see him about a week before he died. And we walked in. I walked in, and his wife said, he's back in his bedroom. Said, he's lucid. He wants to see you. So I go back there, and he is. He's very lucid that day. And I look at him. I'm sitting on the edge of his bed, and I look at him in his eyes. And I said, Jack, I got to ask you something. I said, at a time like this, has fear returned to you? He said, no, not a bit. I said, how, when you're so close, we all know how close you are, how can you lay there and tell me you're not consumed by fear? He said, oh, that's easy. He said, because I believe God is who he says he is. And I knew he believed that. And he looked at me, he said, you know, my old body's wearing out. He said, God made it that way. But he said, my spirit's going to soar. And it does. I feel him at every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I go to. He died 2 months short of his 32nd AA birthday. I can see him right here in this room this morning. See him right over here out of the corner of my eye, sitting over there in that back row with his legs crossed with a cup of coffee. He'd better be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous than anywhere else. I know. I learned more from that man about Alcoholics Anonymous, about our traditions, about loving another human being that I've learned up to that point of my life. He was tremendous, and I miss him this very day. But I got another sponsor, and I've always had a sponsor. I'm not one of those people that feels like I can run amok. I have got to be accountable to somebody. Somebody's got to know about me and know what I'm doing, how I'm acting, because I got one of those magical, magnifying, alcoholic minds. Every time my mind tells me something, it's right. I'm right. I need somebody else that can listen to my stuff. I want to tell you real quick about those kids. Now, we got to sit down and go eat. I know if you want to be talking to yourself, be talking when they ring the dinner bell. I'll tell you about those kids right quick. Kay told you a little bit about them. Those kids were in treatment. They never did really stay sober. That first one, that girl, she stayed sober 7.5 years in AA. And then she got to hanging around with the wrong element of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started getting drunk back and forth at each other. And then she finally left AA. Now, I put that aside because I need to say this because I've seen a lot of young people here this weekend. And I've heard relationships mentioned a few times. Now, I don't know about here in California, but back in Texas, they have what we call AA relationships. And if you come here looking for the opposite sex, you need to know that the odds are good, but the goods are odd. You might want to file that away, too. That's what happened to her. She got in those AA relationships, and they started getting drunk at each other, and she finally left AA and went to Arizona. She got married, had the career, had the big house out in the hills and the big swimming pool and the big cars and the big jobs and all that stuff. And she started drinking again. And then she started taking some other substances. And that divorce came, and she lost all that. She's been in on and off the street for the last about 4 years. She's been in hospitals, been in detoxes, been in psych wards, been in jails. She's almost died half a dozen times that we know of, maybe more. And for some reason, she doesn't want to go to AA. She just doesn't think AA is her way. And I don't know, maybe it's not. But she's got about 60 days now. She just got out of a women's shelter in Santa Fe. I don't know what's going to happen to her. She's not my problem. She's God's problem, because she's God's kid. That's who she is. And I'm not responsible for her. I can't help her. I can't help any of those kids. We know that. That's the other two boys that got out of treatment. They didn't stay sober either. They're the one in the Air Force doing his thing. The one is working hard doing his thing. I'll tell you quickly about that first one. We don't talk too much about him. But let me tell you first about the littlest one. He'd be appalled if he heard Kay say, well, he had 60 days. He's got 120. Because he calls me about every 3 or 4 days, gives me an update on how many days he's got. And he did tell us a few weeks back, he said, if I'd have known AA was this much fun, I'd have gotten sober 13 years ago. And Kay asked him, well, why didn't you? He said, because I would have had to say that he was right, pointing at me, that he was right. And she asked him, she said, did he ever call you an alcoholic or say you ought to go to AA? He says, no, but I think he probably would have. And he may be right. In my old way of living and acting, I may have been that person. But anyway, he's sober and he's loving it and living in a halfway house, and he's doing what he's got to do. That first one, I don't talk about much about her. She's the Al-Anon in waiting. She could certainly enjoy it and use Al-Anon, but she hasn't entered it yet. She's got a 23-year-old daughter that has been in and out of the program, so she's a candidate, but she's never come. But I'll tell you quickly about her. She, about 12 years ago or so, she got remarried after the first marriage. Didn't work out, and she and her new husband moved off to South Carolina, and they hadn't been over there for just a few months, and she called one day and said that she was pregnant with twins and wanted everybody to be happy, and we were. And a few months go down the line, go past, and the youngest one just got sober. He'd been on the street for a while and living in his car. Now, he'd be DePaul if we said he'd been on the streets. Actually, he was living in his car, but it wouldn't start, wouldn't run. So I think it was technically on the street. But anyway, he'd come by our home and wanted to wash his clothes. He was looking for a job, and he was there, and this daughter calls, his older sister. I don't know if you've ever had any kids that leave or not and come back. It's just like they just left yesterday. We hadn't seen this boy in 4 years, and he comes in and starts using a telephone, using the microwave, the refrigerator, everything, just like he'd left yesterday. Anyway, the phone rings, and it's her. But he answers our phone. Hadn't been in our home 4 years. He answers on the first ring. It's her. And she's in the emergency room and wants to talk to me. So he has me the phone, and I say, yeah, what's going on? And she said, I'm in the emergency room, and they're going to take these babies. Her husband was out of town, and she said, they don't know if I'm going to make it or the baby's going to make it. My blood pressure's dropped, and they can't get it up. And I said, look, why don't we just pray right here on the phone? So I prayed with her all over the phone that morning. I hadn't prayed with her since she was probably 4 years old. I said, give the nurse in that emergency room my phone number and have her call me when this is all over and give me an update on you guys. And so she said she would. And she did. And the nurse called him about an hour and a half and said, the babies are fine, but your daughter's still in danger and we don't know, and she's going to be in intensive care for a while. So a week goes by, and she calls back, and that son's still there. He picks that phone up on the first ring, and he's admonishing her for not talking to him the week before. He didn't know what was going on, and I pick up the extension just in time to hear her say, Kyle, you don't understand. I was in trouble, and I needed my daddy. It's the first time I remember hearing that girl say that since she was about 6 years old. When she was about six, I was out drunk one night doing my deal. Came in, and she had had an accident, and her big toenail had been almost ripped off, and they wanted to take her to the emergency room, but she wouldn't go. I was the only one that was going to be okay to take her. And there I didn't get home at about 4 in the morning. That was the same girl who, when she got married that first time, not only did I not get to walk her down the aisle, she called me and said, please, don't even be in the church. Yet that day, she was the same girl that called and said, you don't understand, I needed my daddy. Things like that don't happen to guys like me. But, and except the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could have missed it all. Thank you so much.